From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. If you could use an emoji to express your mood about this year's presidential election, which one would it be?
Obviously, you can see in the tone of my voice, I'm a little worried.
What? Ah, I feel good.
Can I ask you a question? Why are you even running for office?
So, this all seems horrible.
I've seen worse.
No.
We've actually heard those sentiments expressed by you in less dramatic ways. And we're going to play a lot of those comments that you had. We asked you how you're feeling about 2016, and today you will hear some of the answers to that question. This is part of coordinated political coverage from NPR that will span the nation. But we take Georgia's political pulse today. We'll talk about how the candidates, the issues, media coverage, and more are affecting your mood as a voter.
My name is Marilyn Posner. I live in Sandy Springs. Right now, I think there are a lot of contenders running, so I'm a little confused by all the different candidates. Right now, I'm very undecided, I'll be honest with you.
My name is Lee Espiritu. I'm 32 years old, and I live in Atlanta. I'm kind of anxious because I'm very concerned about some of the statements that Donald Trump has said concerning Mexicans and just in different religious beliefs. But I think he does have a good economic perspective in terms of bringing more jobs to America.
My name's Cornelius Brown. It really don't matter to me because I feel like it don't matter no difference who president, who gonna be in the president office, it gonna be what it is. The economy still gonna be messed up. People still gonna be on welfare. People still gonna be homeless in America. Like you go downtown, and it's still the same. So it ain't no different. But I would like Hillary Clinton to be the president.
Confusion there, anxiety, some apathy. What about you? Today is all about you and your thoughts. Tweet us during the show at OST Talk. You can also jump into discussion at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio or call us to leave a message at 404-500-9457. At the GPB main Facebook page, there's a sort of a battle going on between Trump supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters. You can join that conversation too. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So be nice. Let's start today's show with a couple experts on Georgia's political mood. Trey Hood is a political scientist at the University of Georgia, and Andra Gillespie is a political scientist at Emory. Trey and Andra, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's first talk about this anxiety. This is something that a number of polls, including polls coming out of Pew Research Center, have identified. Let me start with you, Trey. Accept this word anxiety as something that a lot of voters are feeling?
I think it could be legitimate. Again, we're right in the middle of this, and I just want to say that sometimes it's hard to figure out what's going on until after we're past the event, which I know doesn't help the radio show this morning, but it's possible that there could be a segment of the electorate that has a higher level of anxiety than normal. We've also heard about people being angry, although every election cycle there's some subgroup that's angry at somebody. So I say all that to say I don't know exactly how much this may affect things or if this is an accurate depiction of what's going on yet. So.
Well, then, Andra, let me put that to you. As Trey pointed out, we always hear about angry people or anxious people before an election. Is it exceptional this time around?
Well, I would argue that we have lots of evidence over many years that would suggest that there's a certain level of anxiety that I think is really kind of coming to a head in this particular
election.
You
mean that it's increased over the past decade or so?
That it's increased, particularly in the last 5 years. And so if we look at the rise of the Tea Party and you drill down and sort of see sort of what their grievances are, those grievances are really manifesting themselves in support for Donald Trump. And especially when Donald Trump taps into racial animus to bolster his own candidacy, he's tapping into these resentments that that we've known for the last 6 years have existed amongst people who are Tea Party supporters disproportionately compared to the rest of the population. And then if you ask people questions about whether or not they feel that they've gotten ahead in the economy, if we look at issues like income inequality, like there's lots of anger to be distributed all around. And I think that that's really contributed to the rise of these anti-establishment candidates on both sides of the aisle.
Okay, so let me play a couple more thoughts from voters. GPB listeners might have heard a piece from NPR's Mara Liasson on Morning Edition today. That was all about voter anxiety, but let's keep it local in Georgia. Political Rewind producer Jenny Ament talked about anxiety with a few young voters in Atlanta, and here's what they had to say.
My name is Marquise Smith. I'm 23 years old from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm feeling quite a bit anxious about the election. I feel like with major elections, especially presidential elections, it really brings out the worst in people. And right now, the whole election just looks like a big reality entertainment show going on right now. It's just like, is this really what our American government is coming to reducing itself to making a mockery, it seems like. So it's just makes you worry a little bit.
My name is Brianna Lewings, and I'm 23 years old. I wouldn't say that I'm anxious, but I'm very hopeful that it is an outcome that is beneficial to the benefit of women and all types of people, equality. So that's my focus, right? I just hope it works out for minority.
It's Tracy Thomas, and I'm 33. I am not anxious on the Democrat side. I'm anxious on the Republican side. Both the Democrats, I feel okay. Like, I don't think there's a lot of crazy on that side. The Republican side is just kind of like, it's been so interesting watching the whole, like, all the debates and everything. It's just, it's very, very interesting to see who we end up with.
Okay. So, Trey, help me kind of parse out what this is that people are describing. It feels like there's a difference between the anxiety feel about the state of the country and the anxiety people seem to be feeling about some candidates. Are those two different things?
I do think they may be, some people at least may be anxious, especially about Trump, probably. To some degree, his candidacy really sort of defies standard explanation, at least right now. I mean, he has tapped into, as Andrea was saying, into at least for some groups, like maybe the white working class, you know, this anger or resentment. He has no political experience, essentially. He's been able to say whatever he wants to without ramifications. So it's interesting, and I think some people would be anxious, particularly about his candidacy, rather than even someone on the other side like Bernie Sanders, who, while he's far to the left, still has political experience, elective office holding experience.
It's so funny you say that, Trey, because we just got a tweet from somebody named Pax Bobro, who says, I'm voting for Bernie Sanders. He's the only candidate who doesn't scream at me to be afraid, buy a gun, and pray. So, Andra, help me understand what is feeding into this anxiety. What's causing people to feel anxious? Is it, as we just mentioned, the candidates themselves, or is there something else going on in the country?
Well, I mean, I think 16 years ago, Bob Putnam wrote this book called Bowling Alone that talks about the decline in social capital in the United States. And so social capital is important because it's the glue that binds communities together. It builds
social capital
trust.
Means?
Social capital, it's the glue that binds people together. It's these feelings of trust. It's this feeling of neighborliness, like all of these things that try to
being part help, of a community.
Being part of a community. And so he noted that people were participating less in society, and as a result, people had less of this glue that was binding them towards one another. And so as he's observing this decline in social capital, we also see this rise in polarization. And it's not just polarization in Washington, D.C. My colleague Alan Abramowitz has found that if we look at public opinion data amongst, you know, general rank and file voters, that they also have very polarized opinions. So Washington reflects the United States. So as we see people becoming more polarized ideologically in their viewpoints and also becoming less trusting and feeling less communal with people, then that really does make you afraid about what the other side might potentially nominate for president. And as you've seen, candidates in the far right and the far left actually gain traction in ways that we're not used to seeing. We're operating under this theory of median voter, which says that you're going to end up with more moderate types of candidates in a two-party system.
Right.
And this cycle just seems to be kind of challenging those theories at every corner. Like, that's something something that could be afraid of people. So you have Democrats who would be afraid if Donald Trump became president. And there are definitely Republicans who would be afraid of the socialist Bernie Sanders becoming president of the United States because it's foreign to them. They don't recognize that as part of their community.
And yet, Trey, there's other things going on. And I wonder, some people point to terrorism as a reason for anxiety. And I wonder if that really is exceptional during this particular cycle. I mean, is it worse now that the fear of say, ISIS than the fear of Al-Qaeda after 9/11?
Well, I don't know that it's worse. I mean, what happened in France recently has probably caused an uptick in anxiety about terrorism. So there's probably something linked to that. I don't know that it's worse than, you know, post 9/11 or in that area.
Well, then let's talk about some other possible causes. You talked about social capital, and I wonder, Andra, if that's a result of some of the changing demographics that we're seeing. I mean, it is fairly recent that we started to hear the statistic that as of not very long in the future, Caucasians will no longer be the majority in the United States. That's a huge change.
Well, one of the interesting and I guess kind of sobering points of Putnam's work back in the late 90s and early 2000s was that culturally homogeneous communities tended to report higher levels of social capital. And so we should be prepared for the fact that, especially initially, as a jurisdiction diversifies, that there's going to be more conflict. Mm. And we haven't figured out sort of how to sort of mediate that. So part of this is going through growing pains and dealing with the demographic. And I think in part, if we look at what, why now, why 2016?
Yeah.
I think it's not it's not by accident that this backlash kind of comes after you have an African-American president serve for the first time.
All right. So let's take a listen to another voter. Here's a young man that Grant Blankenship spoke with in Macon. Grant is a reporter at GPB Macon.
Eric Moore, 26. I would say, as of right now, Bernie Sanders is probably the person I am most interested in. It really depends on what they have to say over the next coming months. Again, I'm actually still surprised Trump's in the running. I don't think any Republican candidate really has. The only one that has a backbone is Trump, but I don't agree with anything he has to say. Jeb Bush has some better ideas, but he has no backbone, therefore would be an awful president. And coming from Florida, we all saw what he did in Florida, which wasn't great either. And Hillary, she has screwed up a lot over the past several years, especially under Obama's administration. So we'll see where she goes from there. If she could possibly sway me, but that's really the only one at this point.
We're going to continue talking about this. We just spoke with Trey Hood, political science professor at the University of Georgia, and Andra Gillespie is a professor of political science at Emory University. Trey and Andra, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, are Black Americans worse off than they were before President Obama was elected? First, though, we'll ask some community organizers to tell us what they've heard while canvassing Georgia voters, and we want to know how you feel about this election year. Here's 61-year-old Edward Judy of Macon on his voter strategy.
The issues that are driving my decision-making process, I'm looking at some of the terrorism acts that are happening. I served 26 years in the Army. I retired as a command sergeant major with the U.S. Army, and I served with the special operations with the Rangers for 15 years. And I just believe the global terrorism that is happening both internationally and nationally, someone has to have a grasp for that. Back at home, it's the economy. The working conditions that I see in my community, particularly among people of color, and the educational process that they're going through. I should say the lack of educational process that many are going through in the community, in urban communities.
Edward Judy is a Republican. He says Jeb Bush is his top pick for president as of right now. Tell us what you think. This is On Second Thought. From the media coverage to the memes, this year's election is... it's different. How does it make you feel as a voter?
My name is Stacey Jones, and I'm 28 years old. I really don't know how I feel about it. I feel like it's a show, like a clown show, really, to be honest. I think that, like, with Trump, I don't feel like he's serious. And I feel like Hillary and Bernie are trying to appeal to certain groups, like, kind of too hard. So I don't feel as interested in it as I did the previous election.
We're checking in on Georgia voters today. That means you. What mood are you in for election 2016? Share your thoughts and your feelings with us on Twitter right now at OST Talk, or leave a comment at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Make it constructive. and productive. No insults. Let's hear from some folks who spend time in the streets actually talking to voters and sometimes potential voters. We have three community activists with us, and Andra Gillespie stays with us. Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University, still with us, and joined by Kelly Persons, program manager for the League of Women Voters in Georgia. It's been a year since we spoke with you, Kelly. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephanie Cho is the interim executive director for the group Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Nice to have you, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you.
And Nse Ufot is executive director of the New Georgia Project. And you guys are all about registering voters.
Absolutely. Civic engagement.
All right. So let's start with you. And let me actually read a couple tweets from some of our listeners. Black physicist says, never will forget what Saxby Chambliss did to Max Cleland. 2016 cycle feels just as rancid. And then April B. tweets, I have a sense of urgency about getting millennials registered and out to vote. U.S. demographics changing. We should hear all voices. And when we asked her how she feels about the 2016 race, and say she says she's feeling punked.
Punked.
So almost as though Trump at some point is going to step out and go, kidding. So but tell me, when you're registering voices, people like this, how are you hearing these concerns echoed?
I am. We are. And I think that that probably comes from a place of the So voter engagement, I think, it's what's lacking and what's missing. I think that particularly Black American voters, so we focus on what is being called the New American Majority at the New Georgia Project, which includes African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, and young voters under the age of 30. And it is still not clear. This is what we've learned from talking to Black voters and young voters, is that there are mixed feelings about Hillary Clinton. We're not sure how deep people are feeling the burn in the state of Georgia, and folks don't know what to feel about Donald Trump. And the rhetoric has been rancid, I think, as one of the Twitter users has said, coming out of the GOP debates. And people of color, young folks, don't know how to feel about this presidential election. There's a sort of dearth of inspiration and hope, and it's with the exception of some energy around the Bernie Sanders campaign. It's still not clear whose message is getting through to young voters and to voters of color in Georgia.
So, Stephanie, let me take this to you, because I was surprised to go on GPB's Facebook page and see almost split 50-50 the arguments either for Trump or for Bernie Sanders. Do these seem to be the only candidates actually inspiring something other than apathy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this year is going to be a really challenging year, but to get people to really look at the issues, I think, is what's really the missing piece, you know, because I think that Trump has a really strong personality, and I think that it's sort of polarizing people, but really I think it needs to go back to the issues. And if the candidates go back to some of the things that they're are really, you know, at the heart of what people want, and particularly with, like, immigrant voters, I think that that's really what's going to turn people around. And I think that that's what's really missing, is that there's this, you know, sort of like, you know, flashy sort of memes and all this kind of stuff, but it's really not about, like, what people really want. And I think that that's the heart of it. Like, people really want to hear what people care about, like issues around the economy, around healthcare, around immigration. Like, those are the things that are missing in this debate.
Well, then, Andra, let me take this to you, because we've talked a lot about anxiety, but what about apathy? Obviously, apathy probably turns people away from the polls. Do anxiety and anger get people to the polls?
So people try to tap into anger and anxiety for people who are really strong partisans. And so if you're a strong partisan and you're particularly knowledgeable, then things like negative campaigns and showing the other guy as being bad are the kinds of things that some people theorize could actually drive up turnout. But what it could actually do is actually end up driving down people who are in your base. So I think the challenge with young voters and new voters in particular is not just that they're apathetic, but usually that they're relatively new to the process. And so there's a lot that they don't know. And so the work that people like Stephanie and Insay and Kelly are doing is to actually help bring them up to a level so that they understand the process and feel confident about the process and then feel that they can participate. Now, what could actually end up demobilizing that group later is that if they feel that their vote just doesn't count ever, like it doesn't matter how I vote, my person never wins. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who I elect, even if it is my person, they don't do anything over time. And that type of thing does actually end up creating the type of sentiments that can depress turnout.
Kelly, do you get the sense that people are actually well-informed about the platforms and policies of the candidates?
Well, we generally see that more on the national level, but I also say this is an election year for all of the state, all of the county, county commissioners, all of the state house, the state senate is up this year. So just as a reminder, there are lots of elections that are going on this year. And the League and all the other groups, especially the ones here, are going to do our best to make sure that folks know when the elections are. But a lot of times, if you don't know when the election are, if you don't know what the voter registration date is, you may be left out in the cold.
Can we just give those dates? I think most people know that the first caucus is in Iowa. It's coming up a week from today. And so let's talk a little bit about this first vote in Georgia. Is it a caucus or is it an open primary?
So it is an open primary. Georgia has what we call an open primary. You don't register as a Democratic voter or a Republican voter. You just register as a voter. And at the time you go to the primary, you select one ballot or the other. The deadline for the presidential preference primary is February 1st, so you do need to be registered to vote by next Monday if you want to vote in that. Early voting also starts February 8th, so you can cast your ballot at the presidential primary as early as February 8th in person. Absentee balloting is already going on. We will have our state primary will be in May of this year. So the voter registration cutoff for that will be the first part of April. And then we'll have a series of runoffs probably about mid-July, and then we'll hit the general in November.
So if you missed some of those dates, you can probably go to the League of Women Voters site and get all your dates because my brain is boggling.
You certainly may, and we'll also have a voter guide for folks looking for that information.
As always, it's something I keep close to me as elections go. Let's hear a few more voices of voters and to hear what they're talking about and then come back and discuss.
My name is Mike Williams, and I stay in Atlanta, Georgia. I just don't want Trump to be president. We want Hillary to be president. Trumpet. He's really trying to set us up for war and stuff, and we're not ready for that. And Hillary, I think she'll give us a chance not to like just go out there and fight, and we don't want to just, Trumpet just want us to go out there and fight.
Dorita Puckett, I am 50. Trump's crazy, but is crazy going to be better than what we've had? Just told my husband this morning, I said, you know what, I've never been a Trump supporter, but you know what, maybe we need that instead of being the same old status quo. Just imagine it being Trump and Putin being president of Russia and of the United States. Let's just picture that.
Asia Morgan, I am 25 years old. Really, I think we should be focusing more so on education and education costs. That's more so what's pertinent to me as a student. By November, when we have our set candidates from the Republicans and the Democrats, it might be a little bit more focused on the issues. Right now, it's more like a soap opera than an actual debate or an election forum.
My name is Craig Kineska, and I live in Stockbridge, Georgia. I don't have a candidate right now. I think I'll have to wait for another few more debates to kind of see where people, you know, start answering the questions and giving more concrete information. I think a lot of them do a lot of good window talking or talking about around the issues, but never really giving a clear-cut plan of how they would do things in the future to make it better.
Stephanie, can you? What we seem to be hearing from a lot of people is they don't think anybody's serious. Are you hearing that?
I do hear that. It was shocking that somebody was basically like, I rather have crazy than, you know, somebody qual. I mean, that's shocking to me, you know, but in some ways not. I mean, I think that the temperature right now is that no one knows where people actually stand. And that's kind of the thing, you know, like that's what
we don't know what
saying.
Their real platforms are.
No, I mean, it's just a lot of flash. It's not really a lot of substance right now. And so until they really start talking about some real issues, I think that people aren't not going to take them very seriously at this point in time. They are just like sort of, you know, just politicking at this time.
So, let me read you this clip, this quote from Mike Davidson. It's a comment he made on Facebook. He says, the one thing that scares me is that people are only looking at what's being said today. If you go back in time to past elections, you'll see the politicians say the exact same thing as that has been said for 50 years. The only person not saying the canned stuff is Trump. can you connect? You're making a face. But, I mean, a lot of people feel like he would... There's a lot of dissatisfaction with Congress, right? I mean, one yes. poll said that they had less approval than cockroaches. So maybe one of the attractions to a candidate like Trump is that they blow up the system.
Right.
What do you think about that?
So, you know, the New Georgia Project, we work with first-time voters and new registrants to sort of teach them how to evaluate candidates on the issues that matter to them. And with a candidate like Trump, who doesn't have a history as a legislator or even as an executive, it's really difficult to say how much of it is bluster, how much of it is posturing and positioning, how much of it is saying inflammatory things just to get earned media, because we don't have a legislative record to go back on with Donald Trump. And so again, with when we're working with first-time voters and people who are newly engaged, you know, a candidate like Trump makes it really difficult because he draws a lot of attention, but he's still such an unknown because he doesn't have a track record.
This is really interesting. And Kelly, I want to read you another comment from Facebook. Matthew Samuel Thomas says, I feel anxious we won't get a president who's serious about campaign finance reform this election. If this issue is not solved, no other meaningful political goals will be achieved due to the corruption at all levels of American politics. The only candidate speaking about this issue is Bernie Sanders. He's the only candidate who will be getting my vote. All the other candidates to me are just the same due to their weak stances on this issue. So in what way, what are you hearing in terms of people's, let me just put it simply, are people looking at the candidates' records?
So I think they're looking at the candidates' records, but a lot of, in the previous comment, of people are still saying the same thing they did several elections ago. I think part of what drives apathy is that we're used to that instant gratification of we vote for someone and we want the change right away. That doesn't necessarily happen, and that's part of it as well. I do think the millennials see it as sort of the choice of the lesser of the two evils, right? Whether someone's ethical, whether someone's not, it's whether that their lack of ethics, whether it helps you or whether it doesn't help you. So a lot of times I think that's harder for the voter to figure out between the two because they don't necessarily see the fine line and the fine policy. They just see the insults being hurled back and forth and the trustworthiness and the electability when there's much more to that than that. And that's really hard to teach, especially for first-time voters who are used to that instant gratification of I vote for this, therefore I get it, not it may have to compromise, I may have to work with the other side. You need to build space to be able to have those types of conversations.
That's
as
an
well.
Interesting point. And so, Andra, a lot of things that one of the things that people are expressing a lot of anxiety over is their own household finances. We've seen a huge increase in the income inequality gap and the wealth gap. And I wonder, to what extent does a candidate who has their own personal fortune, like a Donald Trump, gain credibility that way? In other words, would Ross Perot have gotten more traction today than he did when he ran?
Well, Ross Perot had traction because he was also sort of playing the id and sort of saying things that a lot of people were thinking but were just too afraid to say. And that's really a lot of what Donald Trump is doing. But Trump is much more polished because he's got a lot of experience in front of the media. So as inflammatory and sometimes uncouth as some of the stuff that he says, he's been doing this on, you know, a worldwide platform for 20 years. And so he's actually very, very polished at what it is that he's doing. When we try to predict in political science how an election is going to go, at least in terms of the popular vote, what we factor in is national metrics. So we usually look at GDP growth or decline as a factor that can predict whether or not the Democrats or the Republicans are actually going to win an election. And so when individuals are looking at this, are looking, what they are going to figure out is they're going to figure out sort of how they are standing in relation to what the overall economy is doing. And so that there are distinctions that could be made between, how I'm doing and how I think the economy is doing overall. And so we usually tend to follow sort of the more national metrics.
And we got a comment from Casey Martin who says, I'm voting based on where the money is coming from. I want a politician who isn't accepting money from big banks, big corporations, but from real people. If he doesn't make the ticket, I'm writing him in anyway, going third party. Maybe he's talking about Bernie or maybe he's talking about Trump. We only have 30 seconds left here, Stephanie, but do you think that a politician's personal finances matter, or do they do with the people you're talking to?
I don't think so. I mean, really, it's about the issues, and I think that that's where they're just really not, you know, talking to folks and really hearing, like, particularly with, like, Asian voters. I think, you know, if they started to focus on economy, education, healthcare, and immigration. I think that those things would really, you know, speak to a lot of folks.
Specific
things. And then really then get the conversation moving that way.
Stephanie Cho is the interim executive director of the group Asian Americans Advancing Justice. We also spoke with Kelly Persons, program manager for the League of Women Voters of Georgia. And Nse Ufat is executive director of the New Georgia Project. And with us for most of this hour has been Andra Gillespie, who teaches political science at Emory University. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Just a heads up, the following conversation does make use of some racially offensive language that could be difficult for some to hear, so use your discretion. Things have only gotten worse for Black Americans during the 8 years of Barack Obama's tenure. That's an argument put forward by Princeton professor Eddie Glaude. His new book is called Democracy in Black: How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. And he says the country is in the middle of a great Black Depression. Eddie Glaude joins me now. He'll be in Decatur tonight to discuss his new book. Hi there, Eddie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad you're here because after the State of the Union, I guess this is a really kind of a good time to take accounting of Barack Obama's presidency. And I wonder, we're going to go into kind of some of the ins and outs of your argument, but I wonder how much of the disappointment is because of how high the hopes were, especially among African Americans, when Barack Obama took office.
Oh, absolutely. You know, disappointment always comes when some expectation hasn't been met. I think there was a level of euphoria. I don't know if there was unimaginable expectations, you know what I mean, in the sense that, you know, folks expected him to right the world, that he was a savior or something. But I do know that there was a sense in which maybe the circumstances of Black America might change. But we know that over the last 8 years, and this is not reducible to Obama's presidency, this is a part of our long legacy as a nation, that African Americans, by every statistical measure, things have gotten worse.
Now, I'm going to argue with you on that by every statistical measure, because the statistics that you give us in the book are, you know, unquestioned. Your sources are not arguable. And on some things like poverty, you're absolutely correct that there's a slightly higher Black poverty rate now than when he took office in 2009. But there are ways. For example, the African-American unemployment rate was almost 13% when he took office. It's fallen to 9.5% as of the summer of last year. Mm-hmm. And that's also true for Black youth as well. So it's not every statistical measure, right?
Yeah, but you know, when you think about that number though, right? Think about that number and think about that number in the context of the Great Recession. Not the Great Black Depression, but the Great Recession. When you think about the unemployment figures of the nation at that time, it was around 9.5, 9.6%. And we were screaming crisis. We were screaming crisis as a nation. Now, 9.5% isn't 13% or 16%. I grant that. But the crisis level is still there. And part of what we have to do when we look at those numbers, we have to look at not only who's dropped out of the labor force, we not only have to look at what kinds of jobs have been created in our communities, we have to look at flatline wages. And this, of course, obtains to workers throughout the country, not just simply Black folk. So when we drill down in the numbers, right, we can say that 9.5 isn't 16 or 13%. That's true. But we can also say that 9.5 is, in fact, the number where people thought we had experienced, and people were saying we were experiencing, the worst economic calamity in generations. So when you look at that number in that frame, we still see crisis.
However, I'm the only person in the room, so I have to be your foil here. Mm-hmm. We have seen unemployment much, much higher for African Americans. You could say that African Americans have been in crisis. If you go back to, say, 1974, it's been higher almost 80% of the time for all African Americans. And for African American youth, it's been higher almost 84, 85% of the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of what I'd say in the book is that this is a reflection, right, of the value gap, right? Part of what I want to say is that we don't want to think that African-American double-digit unemployment or the fact that African-American unemployment is consistently twice that of white America, we don't see that as a crisis. And the question is why? Are we talking about recovery? at this point, that the economy has turned a corner. When we look around and we see in Black communities, we see certain communities, pockets of communities, where long-term unemployment is still devastating those communities, where we see, right, rental markets just so brutal. We see folk losing their homes, right? So part of what I'm trying to get at is, why aren't we grappling with, right, the economic reality, the depressing economic reality that's defining the life circumstances of not only my generation, but future generations, right? When you look at the fact that 38% of African-American children are in poverty, 38%, that number is rising, where in other demographics, it's decreasing. And what's interesting about that data point, Celeste, is that for the first time since we've been collecting that data, there are more poor African-American children than there are poor white children. And the striking thing about that is that there are three times as many white children as there are Black children in this country. So part of what I'm trying to suggest here is that there's crisis, that our communities are collapsing, and we need to be screaming from the rooftops.
So here's where we get into the nitty-gritty, Eddie, because in your book, you're not blaming Barack Obama. Mm-mm. That's not the impression that I got.
Not at all. Not at all.
But then when you start looking at what is to blame, maybe not a person, but maybe what force is to blame, this is where it becomes difficult.
Right.
Because when you're talking about Black unemployment, that means that we then have to delve into what is causing people to hire a white person over a Black person. And that becomes very murky. Much of that, mm-hmm. as every study has told us in recent years, is because of unconscious bias, which is very difficult to put your finger on and fix.
Right, right. So I don't talk about unconscious bias. I talk about racial habits.
Yeah.
And the reason why I talk about racial habits as opposed to unconscious bias is precisely because of how difficult it is to get inside the heads of people, right? But habit formation is very different. Habit formations, of course, take place on the inside, but they're also shaped by our social environments, right? So at the heart of the book is this claim that, no matter what we do, at the heart of the U.S. project is what I call the value gap. And the value gap is the belief that white people are valued more than others. And that belief has organized our society since the American Revolution to the point where we elected an African-American president. And we tend to think about the value gap in a way that we want to locate it only with the loud racist, right? The folks who are running around calling people the N-word or wearing sheets or engaging in the kind of bombast of Donald Trump. But actually, the value gap is sustained by our habits, right? By the ways in which we're socialized, by our social networks. I mean, we know that 73% of our social networks are homogeneous, right? That white folks tend to hang out with white folks and Black folks tend to hang out with Black folks, and that opportunities circulate within those networks, right? So I tell the story in the book. You know, my dad was the second African-American hired at the post office in Pascagoula, Mississippi, on the Gulf Coast, and the place where Trent Lott is from, former Senator Trent Lott, and where William Faulkner honeymooned. And when we moved, he decided to move his kids from one side of town to the other side because he knew he had some precocious children. And so we moved on this nice hill, get the big house and everything. And I was outside after, I think the second or third day we were playing. I was outside playing with my Tonka trucks. And all of a sudden I hear the kid's father say, "Stop playing with that nigger." And I grabbed my truck and I went inside, ran inside. It's the first time I'd ever been called that word. And I told my father. And I remember seeing my father's eyes darken, and then he ran outside. Within a few years, many of the white folks in the neighborhood moved out. But this is the kind of standard story that we tell about American racism, right? Some Black family achieves the American dream with the big house on a hill, and then their child is wounded. And that child has to spend a lifetime trying to prove that he's not a nigger, right? But what's interesting is that that was just the icing on the cake. This is what I say in the book. That's just the icing on the cake. Because I knew at the age of 8 that we were moving from the Black side of town to the white side of town. Because in my old neighborhood, when it rained, the neighborhood flooded because of bad pipes. We didn't have paved sidewalks. Our baseball fields weren't as kept, weren't as clean. They weren't as good. The houses weren't as big. The schools weren't as good. So in my lived environment, in my built environment, I learned the value gap. I was habituated in it. So we acquire these habits in the places we live, in the places we work, in the places we go to school. And those habits reinforce the belief that some people in this country are valued more than others. And until we close the value gap and not think about American racism as simply being the product of bad people who do bad things, but think about the value gap as evidenced in the daily choices we make that lead to, in interesting sorts of ways, in very tragic ways, right, the devastation of communities all throughout our country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eddie Glaude. He teaches religion and African American studies at Princeton, and his new book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. I mean, you know, Eddie, I've been covering politics for a really long time. And one thing I have learned, and I'm pretty cynical at this point, is that those who vote get the attention. Mm-hmm. So to what extent are communities in the United States just not using the power that they have?
Well, I mean, on some level, I would agree with you. But on another level, I think the political science data would suggest that it's a little bit more complex, right? A colleague of mine by the name of Paul Frymer, along with the late Ron Walter Waters, talked about how African-American participation in the political process is so distorted and disfigured. There's a language, I think the technical word is that we are a captured electorate. So even when we turn out in massive numbers, right, particularly, and we vote overwhelmingly Democratic, because we have no place else to go, Democrats spend most of their time trying to get us out to the polls with no real sense of obligation to deliver in terms of policy. And so what you have is the base, whether it's Black folk, whether it's labor, whether it's progressives, there's an assumption that, you know, you have the lesser of two evils. We're not as good as as bad as the other guys. You have to vote for us. And then the way in which people govern, right, is they govern to the center right, which means that certain policies that would overwhelmingly benefit communities that are vulnerable, like most of the communities in the Black community, right, aren't really pursued. So on the one hand, I think you're right, right? I mean, the levels of voter turnout in this country are deplorable, particularly among the poor. We see that there's a direct correlation between impoverished circumstances and civic engagement. We know that. Social science data is very clear on it. So if you have more and more poor people struggling to put food on the table, struggling to keep a roof over their house, over their head, it becomes very difficult to think about how they're going to engage in the process. They become very cynical about the political process. And that seems to me a reasonable conclusion given their life circumstances. But at the same time that that's happening, we also have the kind of cynicism of American politics where the Democratic Party can take Black voters for granted. So we voted for President Obama at 95%. Our electorate was the reason why Bill Clinton got elected, but we still got the crime bill.
The crime bill, which helped perpetuate the mass incarceration mostly of African Americans, right, and very tough sentencing.
Mass incarceration, right? And the only thing we get in response is my bad. You know, once we've seen the devastation that has followed from that legislation.
Yeah, he said he regrets it.
Yeah, so part of what I'm pushing here is that it cuts much deeper than just simply going to the polls. And I think this is what the Black Lives Matter folk are doing. It wasn't voting that got rid of the chief of police in Ferguson. It wasn't voting that changed predatory policing in that suburb. So voting has to stand alongside of, right, organizing a more active grassroots movement, because we need to understand Democratic politics is extending beyond the 2-year and 4-year election cycles.
Here's another issue which I would imagine has been plaguing any attempts at progress on this area for quite some time, which is that as soon as a certain number of people read the title of your book, Democracy in Black, and the word enslaves, you've turned them off. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of white guilt that says, look, I don't want to feel bad about this. I'm not a racist. I'm not keeping minorities down. I'm not the problem. And so I don't need to read any more about how hard it is for this group of people. How do you get past that?
By telling the truth. You know, I mean, part of the thing that we can't do anymore is dance the dance. You know, the idea that we have to translate the suffering of Black communities in order to make others feel comfortable has in so many ways distorted the various ways in which we can advocate on behalf of the most vulnerable in our communities. We just have to start telling the truth. And we have to start looking the ugliness of who we are squarely in the face. For the last 8 years, we have been engaged in an extraordinary effort to evade the reality of race in this country.
Is this what you meant when you wrote about people, America sleepwalking?
Yeah, you know, this is Thoreau, right? It goes all the way back to my love of Henry David Thoreau, right? That we don't want to see. It's sleepwalking on the one hand, and it's kind of a willful blindness, right? And it's a willful blindness to protect the innocents, right? America can't be this, right? Because we're the shining city on the hill. We're the Redeemer Nation. So we have to tell the truth. We have to stop sweet talking. We have to tell the truth about the history of a dual labor market. There's a reason why we have double-digit unemployment consistently. We have to tell the truth about a dual housing market, right? Just in New Jersey, just last year, the Justice Department sued Hudson City Savings for redlining. That's not in the 1940s or the 1930s. That's in 2015. So we have to tell the truth about what's happening in our country. And we also have to tell the truth that Black folk aren't lazy, that we're not irresponsible, that we don't live in cultures of poverty, right? That we're out here trying to work hard. And some of us are making bad decisions like all human beings do. But those bad decisions don't account for, right, the devastation, right, that's taking place in our communities over generations. So I'm not, you know, I want us to be uncomfortable because we got to be maladjusted to injustice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to be maladjusted to injustice. We can't just simply stick our heads in the sand.
Eddie Glaude is the author of the new book, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. And he'll speak tonight at 7 at the Jimmy Carter Library in Atlanta. Eddie, it's a pleasure.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
That's our show for today, but we want to get your opinion. Tomorrow we'll talk about the Georgia court case that could determine the value, the monetary value, of a dog's life. If someone killed your dog, God forbid, how much should they owe in restitution? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.